Well, good morning and grace and peace to each of you in Jesus' name. It has been a real blessing to be here. We've thoroughly enjoyed being with you all yesterday afternoon and evening, enjoying the supper together and enjoying the story time together. We thoroughly have enjoyed being here. Thank you for inviting us. And it's especially wonderful to be in Duff and Kathy's church. The affection runs deep between us. We spent quite a few years together at Pilgrim. They were part of our congregation, Duff and Kathy, for close to 20 years, I think, wasn't it? And remember that book, True Discipleship, by MacDonald? And he talked about total surrender in that book. And I'm still motivated and inspired by your example in trying to follow what he taught in that book, True Discipleship. And we watch them try to live out that teaching in their lives. And our families spent quite a bit of time together, kind of growing up together, your girls and our children. And it seemed like whenever we got together, there was always some Bible drama. Some Bible stories played out, and those were rich times. Yeah, and I guess our lives are somewhat similar in that our journeys haven't followed predictable patterns. Kind of zigzag here and there. But I commend these dear people to your congregation. I know you have received them well. They have given of their time and resources over the years. They have given deeply for God's cause and his people. And then, of course, there's Grandma Pat. We all love her. She's a true Anabaptist. I'm sure you know that. She was baptized, I think, you were 84 years old when you were rebaptized. Is that right? 84. I wasn't able to be present for that. That was a precious occasion, Grandma Pat. And she was telling us yesterday, she has all kinds of adventures in her life. She used to be a Republican activist. I don't know why I had to mention that. But she was also a real estate agent and probably the only Anabaptist lady that I knew that at 90 years old was still reading the Wall Street Journal, I think. And she was telling me yesterday about an adventure she had when she was a real estate agent. She was trying to cross a bridge to show somebody a house, and her Land Rover, whatever it was, floated off downstream with both of them inside. So you can ask her about that story sometime. Quite an adventure, and just good people, and we love them dearly. Our loss is your gain. So it's great to be here to fellowship with Duff and Kathy and Sister Pat. So as I thought about what the Lord would want me to share with you dear people here today, my mind went to two scriptures. One in Psalm 78 and one in John chapter 10. And the title of my sermon today is 60, Looking Back and Pressing Forward. And the reason I gave it that title is because this message is as much a reflection for me as for anyone, because my 60th birthday is coming right up in a few weeks. And I've just been reflecting on life and where I want to go in the next 20 years. So 60. Pressing, looking back and pressing forward. And I didn't really understand, I guess, to what extent storytelling is a part of this event, this annual event for this congregation. So I've prepared some of my own stories, which I will share, I hope, to the glory of God. And I want to start in Psalm chapter 78, that familiar psalm where the psalmist recounts some of the stories of God's people, and I'll read the first seven verses. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. I think that's what you're doing here this weekend. You are telling the stories to the oncoming generation and the praises of the Lord so they might also appreciate what God has done and their faith would be built in their younger years. Verse 5, for he established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, even the children which should be born, who should arise and declare them to their children, that they might set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. The power of storytelling. Now let's go to John chapter 10. John chapter 10 is my aspiration for the next 20 years. And here in the first, let's read the first 11 verses of John chapter 10. And here Jesus tells us how we can live the abundant life. And that is my goal for the next 20 years. By the way, I'd like to welcome my father. I just saw that you were here this morning. My dad is here, Willis Miller. And, of course, he married a Pennsylvania girl 3.5 years ago. He married Jim Stump's widow. We call her Grandma Ruth. And they've been living happily ever after. Thank you. I just now saw that you're here. Let's read John chapter 10, verse 1. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up some other way, the same is a thief and robber. But he that entereth in by the sheep, by the door, is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. And when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. And a stranger will they not follow, but will flee from him, for they know not the voice of strangers. This parable spake Jesus unto them, but they understood not what things they were which he spake unto them. Then said Jesus unto them again, verily, verily, I say unto you, I am the door of the sheep. All that ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. The thief cometh not but for to steal and to kill and to destroy. I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd giveth his life for the sheep. Looking back and pressing on into the abundant life. Looking back, we want to show the oncoming generation the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful work. And I'm sure that the rest of you can say this as well, who are 60 and older. We're not worthy of the grace of God, are we? Some of us have experienced his goodness much longer than 60 years. But I think that the younger generation needs to hear about the goodness of God and his praises. They need to hear from us older ones who've been through the battles and who can still talk about the praises of the Lord, his strength and his wonderful works. And I need to hear myself talk about this too, because many of us find it easier to talk about what we've been through than what God has done for us. We want to be able to talk about what God has done for us. So pressing on into the abundant life is going to be at the end of my talk. I have come that they might have life, Jesus said, and they might have it more abundantly. What does it look like? What does the abundant life look like at age 60 and beyond? What does it look like for younger people? And there's, of course, no glory for any of us. I was thinking recently about this verse in Galatians chapter 6, verse 20, where Paul said, God forbid that I should glory save in the cross of Jesus Christ my Lord, by whom the world has been crucified unto me, and I unto the world. So we understand the phrase, I have been crucified unto the world. We sometimes sing that song, Open the Wells of Salvation, dead to the world, would I be, O Father, dead unto sin, alive unto Thee, crucify all the earthly within me, emptied of self and sin would I be. So we understand, we've probably thought quite a bit about being crucified to the world, that I am unresponsive to the world, and I now give myself to Christ. But I was thinking about that, the other part of that phrase, the world is crucified unto me, Paul said. And I was thinking about how staggering that truth is, that through the cross of Christ, the world is dead to me, powerless against me. That is just a staggering idea, because this speaks of the power of the crucified Messiah over the world. And we remember on the night he died, he said, in the world you're going to have tribulation. You're going to have lots of trouble. And we understand what some of that trouble is, especially those of us who've lived a long time. But he said, take heart, be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. But if you had been there the next day and had seen that supposed Messiah dying on the cross, that ignoble cross, the most horrendous way to die, is that the force that overcomes the world? Imagine you were there and you're watching Jesus dying on the cross, his mutilated body, his lifeblood draining out from him to the ground, and you don't know about the resurrection yet. That crucifies the world? That is what renders the world powerless? That? Well, it sure seems like the other way around. The world is crucifying him. But that scene in front of you, overthrowing the Roman Empire, the greatest empire up to that time, that ragtag band of men that followed Jesus around and were following that dying Messiah, those men turning the world upside down? I mean, can you imagine any thoughts like that, standing there looking at that scene? Can we understand a little better, as we heard this morning, why that man Peter, who had some shaky character at times, why he denied him when he saw the power of the Romans against him and the power of the Jewish people? I mean, this didn't make any sense at all. How likely is that? And then later Paul said that the cross is a stumbling block to the Jewish people and is foolishness to the Greeks, or that's pretty much the rest of us. That's really what the cross looks like. But hasn't it proven true, historically true, that the cross is what has rendered the world powerless against us? The world, the cross, has crucified the world. The world has no effect on the believer. The death on that cross outside Jerusalem on that day by that man, Jesus Christ, and the resurrection that followed is the most powerful force this world has ever seen. And one follower of Jesus against the world, guess who wins? The follower of Jesus. You take all the world's military might, and if you could somehow put the one believer in a field and have all the military might of the world aimed against that man, and they would fire all their weapons against that person, all the firepower of the world's armies in one instant against that believer, who would win? The world doesn't have a chance. The believer would win. They could obliterate the body, but the soul would live on forever with Christ. They couldn't touch the believer. That was the most powerful force, that cross. And I say that if I identify with Christ's death and his resurrection, the world has been crucified unto me. The world has been crucified unto me. It has no power, and that is the way to keep the world out of the church. And yes, we must apply Scripture and make particular application, but Living with the cross daily is actually what crucifies the world to us, and it renders the world powerless over the church, and it keeps the world out of the church. The cross does. These are the stories that we need to tell to the oncoming generation, and it's the only thing we can boast in, the cross, because the cross not only saves us from the world, but over the years, the cross has saved us from ourselves, hasn't it? And all of our wanderings and all of our foolishness. So I want to say that at the beginning. The cross is the only thing that any of us can boast in. So I want to start with this story for the children. And the story is about story of the closed door. And I'm surprised to see my dad here this morning. If you want to hear his version of the story, you can talk about it to him afterward, I guess. But the story goes something like this. So my sister and I, we used to have to walk to the road for the school bus to pick us up in the morning. And so we would walk through the woods, and we'd come to the end of the driveway, and there the bus would come and pick us up, just a small van for our church school in the evening. It would drop us off at the same spot, and we would walk maybe an eighth of a mile back through the woods, back to the house. And you know how brothers and sisters are sometimes. Sometimes they have good discussions, and sometimes their discussions aren't so great, and they might even get into some fusses or arguments. And that happened sometimes to my sister and I. And the one day, we're walking back through the woods after school, probably looking forward to the snack at home, you know, and we got into some kind of spat on the way home. We weren't feeling very good about each other. And as we got close to the house, the back step of the garage, my sister suddenly, I guess she wanted to settle this argument, she darted up the stairs and she went through the garage door, and then she slammed the door right in my face, and I could hear the click of the lock inside, and she stood looking through the window, just looking at me, and she stood there, and that really upset me, of course. I was already upset. And what did I do? Well, I thought I would run for the other door. So I ran around the side of the garage, around the front of the garage, and I burst through that door just in time to see her go into the kitchen door. And so I rushed behind her. That door slammed in my face. So I opened the door, followed her into the house. Mom wasn't in the house. She was somewhere else. And then I saw her rush toward her bedroom door. And she rushed into her bedroom door. I was in close pursuit. And guess what happened to that door? This is now the fourth door. Guess what happened? My sister got inside the bedroom before I caught up with her. And she slammed that door in my face. And I could hear the lock click. And I tried the door, but of course it was locked. Now there was no window in that door. What would you have done? Would you have said, would you have gone to the refrigerator, got a glass of milk and a chocolate chip cookie? And would you have said, come, sister, enjoy a chocolate chip cookie with me? I should have done that. But I didn't. You know what I did? I was so angry, I took my foot. And what do you think I did with my foot? I took my foot and I gave that door a big, hard kick. As hard as I could. I'm not sure what I was thinking I would accomplish with that. But do you know what happened? I was very surprised. Can you imagine what happened? What happens when you kick a door? What did she say? Okay. Well, you know, I became educated right there. Because I thought that all doors were solid doors. They were solid wood. I thought maybe I would shake the door, but what I did not expect was that when I kicked that door, I was probably 7 or 8 years old, suddenly there was a hole in the door about that big. This door was a hollow door, one of those interior doors. It was hollow on the inside. And this was a new house, and I had just kicked a hole in the bedroom door. Do you think I was angry anymore? I felt another emotion, and that emotion was fear. What would Mom say, and especially what would Dad say about this? I was sure I was going to get a hard spanking for this. Do you know what happened? Mom came home, looked at the door. Dad came home, looked at the door. And I'm sure they talked to me. Do you think I got a spanking? No. I got something better. Do you know what they did? My mom and dad just left that door there, like that, with the hole in the door. I'm not sure. Dad didn't always fix things either, so I'm not sure what this was about. But I think they left it there for a lesson. And that hole was in that door for a long, long time. Company would come. Why is that hole in the door? Well, there's some explaining to do. In fact, it was there such a long time that it was still there when my wife and I got married, and she remembers seeing that hole in the door. It was probably there for 15 or 18 years as a lesson to me. That was a good way to handle it, Dad. I've since learned that there's a right door to try to go through and a right way to go through it. I will talk more about that. Jesus said, I am the door. Now I want to talk about the story of the sandbox conversion. There was a young man who was taking his own way quite a few years later. And I remember so well, my parents had taken us to another church where I understood the gospel being preached. And I was under conviction. And there were things in my life that were wrong. I was disobeying my parents, doing some things I shouldn't have been doing, had some things in my possession I should have never had. And I remember just the shame and the guilt that was over me, but I was hanging out with the wrong fellows. And one day, I was getting ready to drive the car away, and there at the house, there was a man who I respected a lot, from the new church, who had come to see my parents about something, and he was standing there outside the garage. Meanwhile, I was getting ready to drive this old Pontiac Catalina away. I was probably 14 or 15 at the time, and I saw this man standing there, and there was nothing special about driving this old car on the lane. I guess I got into the car and I was getting ready to go somewhere, you know, on the place with it. And I put it in gear. It had one of those gear shifts on the stick there. I put it in gear and stepped on the gas. Now, unfortunately, what I had forgotten about was that right in front of the car was the sandbox. And a 2x6, maybe 8x8 or something. And it's for the younger children. And the car had been parked so close to the sandbox that I couldn't see it when I got in the car. And I stepped on the gas, and I went bumping over that sandbox, tearing it to pieces. And I thought, this is horrible. And I got out of the car, and the first thing I saw was Paul Yoder over there, standing there looking at me with this bemused expression on his face. You know, this fellow that I respected a lot and looked up to, he was standing there thinking, what in the world is going on with this young fellow? And that struck so much humiliation that it added to the shame. And I don't know if I went over and talked to him or not. But soon afterward, I went down and I threw myself on my bed. And I remember just the shame of everything washing over me. And also now knowing where I could take this. And I poured out my heart to the Lord in confession and repentance, and I got out of there then realizing that I had been converted. And the sky looked bluer and the trees looked greener, and I took a hammer and smashed some things, and I started a bonfire and burned some magazines I shouldn't have had and got rid of this. And I think I told my parents and I told my teacher, and what happened is, though, these friends of mine that weren't a good influence at the time, I somehow wasn't able to talk to them about what had happened. And so a few months later, I unfortunately had fallen back into the same habits and same things, and I was backslidden already 6 months later and in wrong company. But then this well-known Beachy Amish evangelist, Aidan Troyer, who was the Beachy Denny Kenniston. And we had tent meetings at Pilgrim, and he preached the gospel, and he preached about hell and eternity and getting right with God, and that really shook me up. And I decided I'm going to have to go back and renew my commitment to the Lord. And I went home, and I got right with God. And the next evening, I think it was, Raymond Chupp, some of you know him, came to me, and he said, Ken, he's been praying for me, and he's been thinking about me, and he said, you're kind of the ringleader of these young fellows. He said, maybe if you would get converted, the others would follow. Have you talked? And I said, well, I've already given my life to the Lord. Have you talked to those other fellows? And I haven't, no. And he encouraged me to do so. And I remember the spot, I think it was the next evening. It was one of the most difficult things I still have ever done, because those young men meant a lot to me. And we had mocked another young man who had given his life to Christ about six months before that, or almost a year. And I knew that would happen to me, and I didn't want that. I've always kind of been a people pleaser, and I didn't want those young men to look down on me. And I had to make a decision right there. Was I going to go with Christ and give up all for him, including these buddies of mine that probably meant more to me than they should have? Was I going to choose them, or was I going to choose to go with Jesus? And this is a question for all of us here today, actually, because sometimes human relationships, our best friend, can stand in the way of Christ. And I had to make that decision. I was by then 16 years old, I think, almost 16. And I remember the spot. I think it was the next evening. I went there, and I gathered those young men around, and I said, this is what's happened to me. I can no longer do these things. I'm serving Christ now. And I felt very awkward and very small and not very powerful at all. I didn't think my testimony was that great. And I couldn't believe it. By the end of the week, I think all those young men had also given their lives to Christ. Sometimes we have to make those choices, young people. Who are we going to serve anyway? Are we going to serve the world? Are we going to be with our friends? Or are we willing to give up all for Christ? Are you a young person and have not yet surrendered to Christ? Or are you an older person and holding something back from Christ? It's not worth it. Why do we think that hanging on to something will be worth more than the fullness of Christ's presence? If those early disciples threw away everything for the cause of the resurrected Jesus, why wouldn't we do the same? Why wouldn't we follow their example? Now I want to talk about another thing that I am not proud about at all, but I'll go ahead and talk about it. And it's the story of the porn confession. I was exposed to porn at about 6 years old, I think, and it led to a 20-year-old problem. And I want to talk about how walking in the light helped me get rid of it. And there was one time when I had gone away for service, and on my way to that place in the north, I was, I think, 19 years old, or I was 18 years old at the time. I was actually, now, of course, in that day, you could buy the garbage at the newsstands at the airports and places like that. So about the first airport I got to, I'm ashamed to say this, I bought some garbage, and I think maybe took it at least part of the way up to Canada where I was going. And I was so shamed over that, but then, unfortunately, I knew where to find more stuff when I was up there. And I knew I was going to have to confess this to the church. And this might not have been the right thing to do, but I was 19 years old, and I came home then for a little visit 6 or 8 months into my term of service. And I knew I had to do this, so I just, one Sunday morning, when the whole church was there, I got up behind the pulpit and confessed it to the whole church that I had this problem. And like I said, I didn't know any better. That might have not been exactly the thing to do. But I say that Ephesians chapter 5 has an answer for us if there's anyone here struggling with this kind of problem And it's a prevalent problem today because technology and everything has made the delivery of this so much easier. But I'm here to say that there is a solution for this problem. I'm one of those that has, by the grace of God, walked through this problem, and God has delivered me from it. It was a 20-year problem, but by the grace of God, I've been free longer than how it was when it was a problem. But the answer is, one of the answers is in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11. It says there, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them or expose them. And I say, if there's anyone here today, young or old, man or woman, and you know that you're fellowshipping with some of the unfruitful works of darkness, you're actually engaging with this, you're enjoying it secretly, and if you're doing that, it says we shouldn't do that. Those are unfruitful works of darkness. Earlier in the chapter, it's very clear that the wrath of God's going to come on those who practice these things. But the answer is, maybe do it a little more wisely than I did it that day. You don't have to tell the whole church, but you should. It says there, you should reprove these things. That is, if they're in your life, expose them. Voluntarily expose them to someone. Some trusted brothers, maybe your pastors, your parents, or some people that you know you can trust who are walking in the light with these things. You bring those things, and you just expose them. Voluntarily bring them forward, say, I've got this problem. Can you please help me with it? And I assure you there is help. And for me, it did take repeated exposure because I didn't get victory overnight with these things. But with time, with this repetitive confession, this repetitive walking in the light where the light shines in on the dark places in our lives, eventually they'll become healthy and healed. And I say, in this dark world where this stuff has become so commonplace, we can't lower the bar any at all. We still have to protect our families, still put up safeguards. We can still do it. And I encourage you, pastors and elders and parents, fathers and mothers, be very careful to guard your children. And I'm sure that you are thinking about these things. And guard yourself. No one is immune. Everyone is susceptible to these things. But here we are. Don't have any fellowship with them, but rather reprove them, expose them. All right, I want to talk about the story of the great commitment. So when I was 22 years old, this is now for some of the older young people, I was 22 years old, I walked into the classroom where it was after school. There was a certain young lady who was new to our community, and she was teaching at our school. And she had taken over the upper grades. And I didn't know her that well, and she didn't know me that well, and she didn't know my interest in her, really. But I was quite interested in this young woman. So I had a single rose behind my back, and I walked into her classroom after school, and I pulled out that rose, and I said, will you be the flower of my life? And she turned white. Because the way I came across, she thought maybe I was proposing marriage. Right? I say, young man, if you ever do something like that, maybe a little less dramatic approach might be better than that. But she said yes to my answer for a friendship, and a little more than a year and a half later, we were married. It's been over 36 years now, and it hasn't been easy. And it hasn't always been easy. And I've been far less than an ideal husband. But I still say getting married is one of the best commitments both of us have ever made. I was 23, she was 27. We were both a little older for the times. But getting married for me was one of the best and the greatest, most significant steps forward spiritually that I have ever taken in my life. 1 Corinthians 7, you know what I mean. Most of us probably don't have the gift of singlehood. And we'd like to get married. Let's be honest about it. That's just how it is in most places. We'd like to get married, but maybe the commitment seems a little daunting. And I think that there is, in the very air that we breathe today, it's hard for people to make these kinds of commitments. Everybody wants to keep all their options open. this plurality, diversity, and all this. You just want to keep all the options open. Young men and young ladies find it difficult sometimes to make these kinds of commitments. But I say, if God is leading to marriage, don't be afraid to commit. Many have gone the way ahead of you. And I see some young married couples here, and I think that's wonderful. I also want to say that not everyone who is single has the gift of singleness. Is that correct to say that? Can we actually say that? That not everyone who is single has the gift of singleness. And that can be very hard. And we should be understanding of how difficult that can be. But if we have Christ as supreme, with Christ, we can embrace singlehood, even if we don't feel we have the gifting of singlehood. And even if it seems to be a cross, for some people have the gift of singlehood, and it's not a cross, but others don't seem to have it, and yet they can't be married, and it seems to be a cross. If it's one of those, Christ can help you bear it. And I say that you can have a level of devotion and fellowship with Christ that married people often do not have. That's why they're supposed to come apart for a while, so that they can spend special time in fasting and prayer. A single person can have that continually. And that's, I think, the biggest advantage to being single, is that devotion to Christ that we can have. Okay, moving on here. So I'll skip a story or two here and move on to the story that I was asked to share a little bit about last night, the Africa story, the beating, that mob attack where we should have died. There were those people milling around us for maybe an hour and a half, and sitting there in that afternoon in that sunshine there on the Kano Plains, you know. And we've all gone through experiences that are kind of like this, where we thought we were at the end, either physically or emotionally, spiritually, and we're not sure what we're going to do. I thought I was going to die. And I mentioned yesterday how that image came into my mind of me on the ground, God in heaven, and Jesus coming in there as the mediator. And I knew that I wasn't afraid to die because he was there for me. And, you know, the thing that probably affected me the worst, I was talking to some brothers before the story time last night about this. The thing that affected me the most over that time after it happened was just these feelings of remorse and regret and kind of like self-degradation. Like, why did this happen? Why did it have to happen? Could a better man have talked his way out of this crisis or not gotten himself into it? And this is like one of the biggest crises the mission has ever had. We were there just like 4 months. And why did this happen to me? Why did it happen on my watch? I was just tormented with these kind of thoughts. And I think it was an attack from the enemy. And then we had to, I had to appear in court. And 15 of these men were, 16 men were arrested out of this. That very evening, the U.S. Embassy made international news. U.S. Embassy got hold of the information. They put pressure on the local Kenya police, and they sent policemen out, and they arrested 16 men, including the man who rescued us. And these people were charged, three or four of them were charged with robbery with violence, which carried the death penalty in Kenya at the time. It was horrible. And they were, country of Kenya made a case out of it. We were called to go in and testify against the perpetrators of this crime. And we were worried about, you know, hit men coming out of Nairobi and, taking out the witnesses. And that was a thing with fear that we were dealing with then. And we ended up then going to the courtroom, and I had to talk about what happened that day by request of the Kenyan government. That was such a hard thing. Never expected to have to do that on this mission assignment. Now remember, I wasn't going to share this, but I will share this just by way of encouragement. One of the great experiences of my life was that day when I had to appear in court, and these men smelled because they were in this horrible British era prison in Kenya. And it was about as like a concentration camp. These men were being held there in a tight, crowded room. It was one of those cases where there were cockroaches, and they were so crowded that if one man wanted to turn over at night, they pretty much all had to turn over. And so you could smell them across the courtroom. And that one day, I realized that they were being held below the court in preparation for appearing that day where I was going to have to bring testimony. And I knew they were under there, and I went up to the gate, and there was a guard there guarding the iron gate. And I asked, could I get something for these men? And he knew who I was, and he looked at me as though I was crazy. He gave me permission, so I went across the street to one of these little stands and bought, there were still 15 men there, I bought 15 of these large Coke bottles, ice cold. And I carried two or three heavy bags. I carried them across the street and went to the gate there, and he let me in. And these men were in this holding area downstairs, and I went to a table, the guards with me, and boy, were they ever surprised to see me. And I had a can opener, and I sat there at the table and motioned, and the guards told them, and I motioned that I was giving them each a cold Coke. And they started coming up. Not everybody came. Maybe 10 of them came up. And the most satisfying, one of the most satisfying feelings of my whole life was to hear the swoosh of the cap coming off that Coke and being able to hand those men a Coke in the name of Christ, in the name of His forgiveness. It was a very moving and touching time. I'll never forget that. So then moving on through the journey of our lives, you know, most of you probably heard about this Lisa Miller child custody case, and we're praying for those of us who ended up in prison on account of Lisa and Isabella. We thank you for your prayers. We felt them very much. And the grace of God came through those prayers and helped us. But one of the life's greatest disappointments is tied up in that story for us. Back in May of 2009, our congregation had released us to go serve in the country of Ireland in the Dunmore East community. And we had visited there, and we loved the international church there. And the strategic thing about Ireland is that if you went over there, you could go in under a business visa that had been established, and you could, after about 5 years, become a citizen of the country of Ireland without renouncing your U.S. citizenship because of the relationship between Ireland and the U.S., which meant that you could carry both passports. That's possible in other countries too, of course, but what's really unique about Ireland is that since it's also a member of the EU community, it meant that once you get your Irish citizenship, you could then live and work and be a legal citizen in any of the, what is it, 27 European Union countries. And that was our goal when we answered this opportunity, this call, go to Ireland. You know, we were still finishing raising our family, and the dream was we'd move to Ireland after about 5 years. You know, we'd get our Irish citizenship, and then to that was the gateway to the European countries that needed, you know, they needed the kingdom witness. And we had this vision of, in my mind, of finishing raising our family and then seeing our children possibly move out across the European Union and settle in, and maybe there'd be churches established out across Europe. So in May of 2009, we began making preparations for spending the rest of our lives in Europe. We decided to take a year to prepare ourselves and to get out of some obligations at home and get rid of our things. And we were making those preparations when in the fall of 2009, this mother and daughter came looking for help, and we helped them. And we kept our plans. We moved to Ireland then in July of 2010. And in October of 2011, less than a year and a half later, we got this call from the FBI in Ireland, reaching out to me in Ireland. And then, of course, we came back to face this situation, hoping to return back to Ireland to our place there after about a year. Well, I came back, I self-surrendered to the authorities, And then we realized that this was really going to be a big deal. And the realization settled in that we weren't going to be able to fulfill the dream of living the rest of our lives in Europe. That was a bitter disappointment. I still haven't fully recovered from that. But that's just our experience. Many of us have had similar experiences. Who knows, they may not be quite as dramatic as some of these experiences, but they affect us the same way. They affect us just as deeply, just as wholly, and our lives seem to be shattered, and the things we wanted to do for God just aren't working out, and they all affect us kind of the same way, very deep, very personal. And what do you do with broken pieces of life's shattered dreams? What do you do with those? Well, the first lesson I think we can learn from this is we can't allow ourselves to become bitter about the things that have happened. And I think the lesson we're still trying to learn is to give up what seemed to be the broken pieces of our lives back to God. And He can make them whole again. He can make something beautiful out of those broken dreams. So, looking back, I do not regret for one moment giving my life to Christ. And I say it's worth it. You know, it's a struggle being a Christian in this world. It sure is a whole lot worse struggle being in this world without Christ. I don't know how people make it. So as I look back, I do not have one regret for one moment giving my life to Christ. Young people, it's worth it. There's someone here who's not yet made that decision, and you know you're being called to follow Christ. Don't delay that decision. Make it today. The only regret I have are those times when I wavered or went back and was not obedient. I can only glory in the cross that has overcome the world and has overcome my own weak self. So now pressing on into talking about the abundant life. What do we want going forward? And going back to John chapter 10 now, one of our ministers at home is working through the I Am sayings of Jesus. And the last one that he covered was the one saying in John chapter 10, I am the door. And that sermon was very thought-provoking for me, and I put it together with something that, believe it or not, Dietrich Bonhoeffer said many years ago in his book, The Cost of Discipleship. And I put those two things together, and what kind of follows is a result of that meditation from this sermon at home and Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So if we go back to John chapter 10, you can turn there if you like. I'll just quickly review some of the things that we have here. There's many words and phrases in John chapter 10. I know we all love that passage. Many, many words and phrases in there that speak into what we need as people. There's so much comfort here and so much truth that Jesus says that speak into the basic needs of people. There's phrases like, I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. He calls his own sheep by name and they know his voice. He leads them out and he goes before them. They shall go in and out. They shall find pasture. I am the door. If any man enter in, he shall be saved. So much comfort and healing here. And here in this picture, we might have a picture of a sheepfold. You've all heard this. You've got this enclosure, maybe a stone enclosure with an opening, and the sheep go in at night, and maybe the shepherd lies in front of that opening at night to keep the marauders out and to keep the sheep in. So we have in these 11 verses that we read, we have Jesus both being the door, and he's the shepherd too. I am the door, I am the shepherd. So here's the shepherd guiding the sheep in and out, and here's the door, possibly the door being the shepherd himself lying there at night and protecting the sheep. Or he's also the opening, the way in. And so here we have this, we have a picture here, I think, of the abundant life. You know, later in that passage, well, in verse 11, is it, he says, verse 10, I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. Here in this sheepfold, with the shepherd guiding the sheep and leading them out, and with the door of the sheep, Jesus protecting the sheep and providing for them an open opportunity for them to walk into. That's the door. So in this image, I think we have the abundant life. Right there it is. I am come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundant. What we see here in this picture of the sheepfold, we have security here? That's what people are looking for. Many people are fearful today in this world. So much fear. They want fellowship. They want some kind of community. It's a basic human longing and a basic human need. We need security and we need fellowship. But they go in and out and they find pasture here. People need nourishment. We need to be fed. We need what satisfies us. Right there in this picture that Jesus paints of himself and of his sheepfold, we have those three things. We have fellowship, we have security, and we have nourishment. Three of the most basic human needs. And I say that's the abundant life. Right there we have it. What more could you want than this? The fellowship with Christ and the fellowship with the fellow sheep, I guess. Fellowship with fellow sheep and the nourishment and security that we have with one another. How can we get that kind of life? Jesus said, I am the door. So now if I would walk over here to this doorway, I won't do it, but I could open that door and we would have an opening. There it goes. Look at that. The door has opened and now we have an opening to the outside. We have an opening to the outside right there. And the door of Jesus is a doorway to the opportunity, the privilege of the abundant life. And we get there through the door of Jesus' person. And sitting there listening to that brother preach the other Sunday, I thought of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and what he said about 2 Timothy, I think it's chapter 3, I don't remember the verse. There's that verse that says, there is one mediator between God and man, the man Jesus Christ. And Mr. Bonhoeffer, he took this out of context, but it's still true, I think. What he says there in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, I forget which chapter 8 or 9, I think. He says that, in essence, Jesus not only is the mediator between man and God, but between man and man. Jesus is the mediator between God and man, in that, in front of every person, if Christ is Lord, then between me and every other person stands Christ. He stands between me and that person, and he also mediates that relationship. And I think it's true. If Jesus is Lord, he should be in front of everyone else. And he stands there in front of that person between him and I. And if he is Lord, then I will relate to him, that person or her, through Jesus. He stands in front of every other person that I meet, and I must go through Jesus, the mediator, to relate to that person. If he is Lord. And if we could remember that, it would completely change, wouldn't it, how we look at the people we meet. If we would meet them through Jesus, the mediator. But similarly, then, I was sitting there thinking about this idea of Jesus being the door, the way into the circumstance that lies in front of us, the way into every moment of time that lies in front of us, the way to every person, the way through every difficulty. There is a doorway in front of us continually, isn't it? Wouldn't it be Jesus' way of doing things? He is the doorway into every situation, every decision, every circumstance, every person. We face the doorway continually all day long. Do we enter this circumstance, this person, this next moment, this next decision through Jesus' way? Or do we climb up some other way or try to find a way to force ourselves through with our own angry way? You know, and if we do that, if we fail to take Jesus' way through the door, but try to force our way through, you know what happens? The one who climbs over the wall is he is the thief. And the thief comes to just kill and steal and destroy. Isn't that what tends to happen? If we enter into a circumstance without going through Jesus, the door of Jesus, we tend to make a mess of things, don't we? Even without trying. But the abundant life is through the door. He says, I've come that they might have life and that they might have it more abundantly. And I've just started thinking about this. Now, what my goal is for the next 20 years, I don't think I have very many goals, except I really want to understand this kind of life better. Jesus said, I am the door. To the extent that we take his way into whatever circumstances lie ahead, to the extent that we allow him to mediate the next moment or be the mediator between the person in front of us, that's the extent into which we will enter the abundant life. He's the door, not only into the initial experience of salvation, but into everything we face. When we enter the door into the abundant life, or will we climb up some other way and leave a trail of killing and stealing and destroying behind us, even while we're attempting to serve Christ? And I think we do that sometimes because we forget that Christ, the door, is a strangely shaped door. The shape of Christ's as door is not your ordinary shape like that, like a rectangular shape, square shape. The shape of Christ's door is more like this shape, the cruciform shape. And we must face that door and enter into that cross-shaped door. And to enter into the abundant life, I don't think there's any other way, really, as I look at history and as I look at the scriptures and I look at how people have lived, I don't know that there's any way into the abundant life except through this cross-shaped door. To get into the abundant life means that we have to embrace suffering. And entering that door, I think, requires us to be poor in spirit, as he taught, mourning over our sin, being meek, hungering and thirsting for justice, seeking to be merciful, to be pure in heart, to be peacemaking people. And yes, at some point, it will involve some kind of persecution if we seek to enter that kind of life. He's that cross-shaped door. The door is the shape of the cross. But you know, on the other side of that door, it says there in Matthew chapter 5, is the kingdom of heaven. There's comfort for mourning. There's the inheritance of the whole earth. There's satiation. We get filled. There's mercy. There's the ability to see God. The privilege of being called his children. There's rejoicing, leaping for joy, and exceeding gladness on the other side of that door. That sounds to me like the abundant life. And we can find that by going through the door that is Jesus. And that's the life, that's my goal for the next 20 years. I want to, after looking back, after all that has happened, and only glorying in this cross, the cross has saved us from ourselves, that's what I want to do in the next 20 years, is pursue more of that. In almost a year and a half, I'm closing now with this story. Probably the last year and a half has actually been the most difficult time in our whole lives. At least it's been for me, easily. The last year and a half, but about a year and 4 months ago, I held in my hands our dear daughter-in-law Grace's frail hand as she lay dying of a very aggressive form of ovarian cancer. She was there in a hospital bed. We found out about this cancer 3 weeks before she passed. And that day, her and her dear husband, our son David, they had decided that, the doctors had basically said it's over. The cancer had invaded her liver, and it had swollen maybe 3 times the size, and she was filled with cancer, and some kind of blood pressure machine was keeping her alive. And they decided that at 6 o'clock that Sunday evening, they were going to remove that presser and let God take her. They made that decision together. So we were meeting her in her final cognizant moments, and it was my turn. So I went up to Grace, and I took her frail hand in mine, and I put up my face tightly against her face, and I said, "It's Daddy." She said, "Yes, I know." And I said, "Grace, we release you to be with Jesus. Don't be afraid." I was surprised by her response. She was a woman who dealt with OCD a lot. We didn't know how severe the situation was for her. She hated hospitals and blood and all that. But she wasn't afraid to die. And she said, she had a beautiful testimony. She said, "I'm so excited. I can't wait to be in his presence." And she emphasized presence. And then she squeezed my hand with a strength I didn't know she had. And I knew she was going to be okay. Less than 24 hours later, this beautiful young woman, 32 years old, was gone. And my wife and my son's wife, he had just been recently ordained 8 months prior. My son's now a widow. I think that was the hardest thing I've ever been through, accepting the fact that a beautiful young lady that was close to us and loved by so many people would be taken like that. Recently, I started to tell someone, tragically, she went to be with the Lord. I thought, well, that doesn't sound right. Tragically, she went to be with the Lord. But it is tragic. It is a tragedy. But she went to be with the Lord. She passed through the door, finally, and into the life that is truly abundant. And I want to follow her. Let's, if we can, kneel for prayer. Thank you, Lord, that it's worth it. Following Christ is worth it. We look back at our wanderings and the journeys we've all been on with Christ, all the difficulties, the pain and the struggle. I know there's many people here today who've experienced things that have been just as hard to them. Their particular circumstances have been crushing at times. And if they haven't faced them yet, they're going to face them. But I thank you that we can look back at your faithfulness and tell of your power and of your strength and of your wonderful works to the oncoming generation, and we can have this confidence that Jesus has overcome the world, that the world has been crucified unto me by the cross of Christ, the only thing we can glory in. Thank you that the best is yet to come, and we look forward to the day when we can finally walk through that door for the last time with Christ. And we pray that you'd bless this congregation and bless our fellowship this afternoon, and we pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.